Morning, Mark. I'm a little old and tired. I've been flying a lot. I was in Norway doing the show that I'm doing in Eugene, and I did it 7 times in 9 days in different cities.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, flying most of the time, because the trouble about Norway is it's all mountains and fjords, so you can't drive very easily.
Right.
But I shall recover my spirits or my energy in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, considering that you've been performing and working diligently over the past, 40 years, I'm not surprised you're a little bit bushed. Well, let me just say right up front that I am an absolute huge fan. I'm thrilled to have you on the show, but I'm going to try as hard as I can not to gush like a starstruck jackass.
Oh, I don't mind. I like a little bit of gushing, actually. It cheers me up.
You're brilliant and a genius.
Thank you. Thank you. Keep it going.
As I was looking over a lot of information about your illustrious career, I thought I would start right at the beginning. Middle name, Marwood. Anything funny to say about that?
No, it's a disaster, and I wish I could get rid of it. It was my mother's father's name.
I see.
And she was under the delusion that it would prove very helpful to me in my career, because he was such an influential auctioneer in Weston-super-Mare, this dreary little town which I grew up in, and which we make a lot of fun of it in the show, actually, because it really, nothing ever happened there, you know. Comedians traditionally seem to grow up in particularly boring towns.
I noticed, too, where Mom was an acrobat, and I thought, well, I wonder if that's where he got his entertainment and comedy.
No, I'm afraid that was a joke.
Oh, really?
I told somebody once, because you get bored sometimes answering the question, I told somebody that she was an acrobat, which is just about the opposite of what she was. You know, she was a dumpy little five-footer. And it got put in the official biography, and I keep taking it out, and it keeps coming back in there. It probably got the bit in about my dad blackmailing people. Well, I made that up, too.
Oh,
he used to sell
funny.
Insurance. A lot about my relationship with my mother in the show, because it was very crucial to my comedy. We both had the same kind of black sense of humor. But a naughty joke that I make about her was that her maiden name was Cross, and we all have one to bear.
I noticed that early on, that this alerted me to, gosh, it was funny right out of the shoot, about you with the footsteps and the big statue walking off its pedestal to the toilet at prep school.
Well, yes, that was a story that I was told when I arrived at Clifton College in Bristol. So it's actually not true about me at all. But what happens is, as you get well known, these stories that happened probably in that case 70 years ago, 80 years ago, they start getting told about you because it's more interesting than telling the story about Joe Snooks who became a plumber. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And therefore, again, that wasn't true. So once sometimes wonders all this information out there on the internet, and as far as I can see, only about 40% has got any truth in it.
I can't stop laughing about you with at a very sad occasion, Graham's funeral, but you delivered the eulogy so
yes.
Masterfully.
Well, that was one of the great occasions, great Python occasions, because we were all very upset. But Graham, you see, I say this in the show, I say, you know, he really loved bad behavior on formal occasions. And there's a lot of stories about really how naughty he was. He was just terribly funny. But any time you sort of put him in a suit and made him try and behave properly, he would immediately behave as badly as he could. And when I was writing that speech, you know, for the memorial, he was hovering over my shoulder, just telling me not to start doing anything in mindless good taste. He wanted me to do something outrageous, which of course I did.
By dropping the F-bomb during the eulogy, which was very funny, and you had the audience.
The F-bomb was then repeated by every other speaker at the memorial service.
Really funny stuff, which also I thought was funny, your collaboration with Graham Chapman. Maybe this was made up too, but that you guys would both work, you'd be doing all this work, he wouldn't say anything for a long time, and then all of a sudden pop out with something that would elevate the
stage. That's exactly right. I mean, he was deliciously lazy. But he had two great things. He had an extraordinary off-the-wall sense of humor, and just when you were writing something that might be becoming prosaic or a bit pedestrian, you know, Graham would come up with something really splendid that would take you off in a new direction. And the other thing was, he was a great sounding board. If Graham laughed, the audience was going to laugh. Mm. And in the early part of your career in particular, that's godsend to have someone there who lets you know whether the audience is going to laugh or not, because that's what it's all about.
Do you have any idea how big of impact in radio, for sure, now for something completely different ended up being?
No, I really didn't. I did over 100 of those shows, and they relied, they were fun, but they relied much too much on the pun, which I've never thought was a very high form of wit. I like occasional puns, but, you know, they were sort of, it was wall-to-wall punning. But do you mean that affected or has influenced people working in radio?
Yeah, I think for years we've all kind of considered it radio gold to switch gears with the, and now for something completely different. You know, love that line. I wondered if it, how it was for you to go from working with really funny people to someone like Robert De Niro, who isn't known for being just a hilarious. Was that a tough change, or you just kind of went with the flow?
Well, the interesting thing about that movie was it was really the first time in my life when if I got a laugh, I'd screwed up. And I actually did something, because people often say to me, and I don't know if they're flattering me or whether there's any truth in it, that they only have to see me and they start smiling. Now, I don't know if it's true, but let's assume that it is. I thought, if I appear on screen in Frankenstein and they immediately see me and start to smile, I have screwed up the movie. So I had a prosthetic made, a sort of a set of teeth. And I'm proud to say that a number of my friends went to that movie and didn't even realize it was me.
Is that right?
Isn't that extraordinary? Just
yes.
By changing that central panel of my face around the teeth. But, I mean, De Niro's a very nice guy, and we had dinner together. And don't forget, he made one of the great American comedies, Pupkin, Robert Pupkin.
Oh, right.
Marty Scorsese's A King of Comedy.
Right.
If I had to choose 10 movies, that would be one of them.
How do you maintain such a poker face? You know, how do you not start laughing at yourself?
Because you're trying to remember the bloody thing. That's the thing. People forget that you're memorizing stuff, you know? And if you start, on stage it's all right, because after a time you know it so well that it's okay if you ad lib a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're out working, as far as I'm concerned, on film with another performer, you want to try and figure out how to make it work as best it possibly can. And that involves, for me, quite a lot of rehearsal and then remembering exactly how I'm going to do it. So I'm kind of too focused on film and on television. You know, if you get giggles if you do Third Rock or Will and Grace or even Cheers, as I've done, you do get giggles a bit, but mainly you're trying not to screw it up. And, you know, because you don't want to mess up the show for all the nice people who've asked you to be on it. That keeps you focused. So it's much more when you get on stage and get really relaxed after a few performances. That's when you start breaking up.
We're chatting with John Cleese. He'll be in Eugene on November 4th, A Final Wave at the World or the Alimony Tour, Year One. I assume that relates to number three.
Number three, that's right, to whom I have to pay $1 million a year until I am 76, despite the fact we had no children. So this means that it keeps me out there in Norway. All the people were saying good for his ex-wife, because otherwise he wouldn't be here entertaining us.
And it says here the show Zany Hilarious World of Comedy, as well as Most Pressing Medical Problems.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that was just a silly thing we put in, because I did a version of this show about 3 years ago and toured it in New Zealand because I wanted to have a chance to work the material with an audience well away from the spotlight of publicity, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And people said, why are you going to New Zealand? And I said, because it's as far off Broadway as you can get without leaving the planet. And it's great when you're trying new material, just to do it to an audience without too much pressure and find out what they like and what they don't like. Because even after, 43 years in show business, I usually have some idea whether the audience is going to think it funny, but I never know whether they're going to think it a bit funny or a lot funny. It really catches me by surprise all the time.
A couple of things that I thought was just hilarious, the swallow-obsessed guards in the Holy Grail.
That was a wonderful bit of material. And written by Jones and Palin, who don't usually write very good stuff.
What about your mistrust of folk dancing?
I remember Bill Oddie said once about folk music, you know, they take a perfectly good tune and folk it up, you know. That's been my attitude with anything that's got the word folk in it now, particularly if you go on a sort of tour of a boat cruise or something, and at some point in Greece or Albania, people come on stage and do folk lorique, as it's always described, you know, folk dancing, which is always awful because it's done by folk who have no particular skills, you know.
Yes, for sure. More clogging all the time, you know?
Yeah, that's right, clogging, yeah.
Do you still see the old chums, Eric and Michael? And
yes, we met together for a shoot for Vanity Fair a few weeks ago. But you see, we're so spread out geographically. I mean, Gilliam is always traveling all over the world, publicizing his film or in search of budget for his next film. I don't think he's ever in the same place for more than a week. I've been traveling a lot, but based now, at least in the winter, in Santa Barbara, because the weather's so lovely. Mm-hmm. And then three of us are in London. So getting all of us together as we are in New York this week is a bit unusual.
Any plans to be in James Bond upcoming movies at all?
Well, they'll only tell me at the last moment if I am, and there was a bit of a feeling that the last one lacked humor, that nobody felt that about the previous one that Daniel Craig did, which I wasn't in either. They decided at that point to take out Moneypenny and Q because they felt that the humor wasn't quite as gritty as modern taste liked the genre to be. And then they seemed to change their mind. So I don't know. I like working in it because it's such a family feeling, you know. And it was wonderful in the first one to be working at Pinewood Studios with people whose grandfathers had worked on the first Bond.
And I know we just have a couple of more moments. Enjoyed your work with the Muppets.
Oh, that was a great experience. I'm very, very fond of the Muppets. I appeared in one of the movies and consider myself a great friend of Frank Oz, you know, who does Fozzie Bear and Miss Piggy. Lovely man. I always wanted to work with him because he made a marvelous film called Death at a Funeral, which nobody knows about. I commend it to your viewers, Death at a Funeral.
And musically, we're a 40-year rock station. Who do you like to listen to musically?
I love people like Harry Nilsson, Newman. I thought it was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
I love that kind of thing. I love all those very witty songs from the 30s, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I love to listen to John Williams playing the guitar. I like what I call light classical. I can't cope with Bartok or too much Bach, you know, but Tchaikovsky I'm a sucker for. And I love the Beatles, but I have never, ever enjoyed rock music, which will astound your audience. But it's just true, you know, some people don't like strawberries. I never understood rock music, and I cannot think of a single track that I've ever heard that I particularly like.
Well, it's been our pleasure to chat with you. You're certainly very diverse, from comedy, movies, political, sports, business. You're an educator. What haven't you done, sir?
I'm run for president. I wasn't born in America. I think that's an awful job, isn't it?
That's right. We so look forward to your show on November 4th. We will keep hyping it up.
We're sold out almost everywhere else. You know, we're sold out in Seattle and Portland and Modesto and Arcata, but not in Eugene. So I hope you will try and persuade your viewers to turn up, even if it's at the last moment.
Yes, they're notorious for the walk-up, you know, half hour before the show. Oh, geez, we got to get down there and see John on stage tonight, yeah, that kind of a thing. So
I like that much better, actually, than being prepared 6 months in advance. But anyway, nice talking to you, Mark.
You too, and we'll look forward to seeing you November 4th.
Great.
Take care, sir.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.